Our second case this morning is United States against Travis. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
May it please the court, I am Captain Babu Kaza, and I represent the appellant in this case, Sergeant Matthew Travis. Chief Judge Efron, with your permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
May do so. Please proceed.
This case raises a fundamental aspect of the military justice system, which is that lawyers advise, but commanders decide. The facts and circumstances of both the crime in this case and the post-trial error on which this court granted review invoke the uniqueness of the military justice system. The military justice system requires commanders ultimately to hold their service members accountable and decide what they will or will not hold them accountable for, particularly in combat environments. Our system acknowledges that there are certain aspects of combat, certain aspects of operational environments that we have to let commanders make the final judgment on outside the legal system. Additionally, this case raises a secondary aspect of the military justice system, which is that this is an expeditionary system, that circumstances occur such as those which occurred in this case, where the trial defense counsel is in North Carolina during the post-trial process, but the SJA and the convening authority are in Iraq at Camp Fallujah during ongoing combat operations. As a practical matter, the only way trial defense counsel could submit correspondence back and forth with the SJA and vice versa was through the use of email. The nature of the error in this case directly was that the trial defense counsel used email to submit clemency matters, and for whatever reason, through some type of communication error, these clemency matters were not received by the SJA's office.
Is that an dispute that the email was sent?
Your Honor, the appellate government counsel in the government brief appears to raise simple implication that maybe the email was not sent. However, you have the affidavits of both Corporal Oswalt and Lieutenant Colonel Newman, and you also have in the joint appendix the actual email, joint appendix of page 153, the email which indicates on 29 November at...
My real question is, is the government, I mean, it's a question for the government really, but are they contesting the validity of the email and all that?
They are contesting...
I'll ask them. You can argue your own case. Who provides the government email system? Is that provided... The thing that this was sent on, is that a government email system?
That is correct, Your Honor. I believe it's unclear whether the NMCI, the Consolidated Network, was in place at this time. However, regardless, it was a government email system used by both the SJA and the Trial Defense Council when the clemency matters were submitted, which is obviously controlled by the government.
Counsel, the CCA said that they couldn't tell from the record when these matters were submitted. So, as I see it, there's no factual determination here as to when or whether they were submitted. What can we do with that? We can't find any facts.
That is correct, Your Honor. However, I think the primary aspect of appellant's case isn't necessarily on the specific fact of whether the email was or was not sent on 29 November, whether or not the government did or did not receive it on 29 November. The broader legal issue, which this court can address, is the conduct of the SJA in light of that fact that apparently they didn't receive email. Two aspects of the SJA's conduct.
So are you conceding that the CCA found that the thing was not submitted, or just that it was not received, or they one and the same?
That the CCA didn't make a specific factual ruling, Your Honor. What the CCA did was say, we can't decide, we can't make a decision whether it was or was not received. However, we're just going to say...
Are you saying submit and receive are the same thing?
No, Your Honor. Those are two...
It sounded like you just agreed with the predicate of Judge Rivlin's question. What is it, in fact, you're agreeing with?
That CCA set aside making an actual determination and simply said there was no prejudice. So even putting aside the actual factual considerations, we're just going to go straight to the prejudice analysis. And based on the second convening authority's action, there was no prejudice. So under that analysis, there was no factual determination.
Are you saying that there was a gentleman's agreement with the SJA that he'd wait on this thing no matter when it showed up?
Not specifically, Your Honor. Obviously, there was never an explicit agreement to even use email, but as a matter of course, in the matter proceeding between the two parties, email was used to submit these matters. Now, trial defense counsel did ask on separate occasions for additional time.
And he got it.
And he did receive it, Your Honor. His final email, he specifically said, I have everything ready to go. It's all signed and ready to go. I'm simply waiting on a letter from Lieutenant General Mattis, the previous communicator in this case. Obviously something of great importance that he wanted to wait on. The SJA did communicate to his BlackBerry, I believe, in his own leave, that he could have until 29 November to receive that. So opponent's argument is twofold. There's two periods of the SJA's conduct. First, what happened immediately after 29 November when he didn't receive the clemency matters. And second, what happened once he found out that clemency matters were attempted to be submitted at the very least.
Well, counsel, just to stop at November 29th, would you agree that on November 29th that the SJA didn't have clemency matters, that he was fully able to submit an SJAR to the convening authority at that time?
Yes, Your Honor. Ultimately, I think it's a matter of discretion, but I would certainly acknowledge that under the technical black letter rules, the SJA probably had discretion to take action if he didn't receive clemency matters. However, I would argue that would be an abuse of his discretion under the facts of this case.
Well, at what point did it become an abuse of his discretion? On November 29th or at some later point in time? I mean, and if it was an abuse of discretion on November 29th, why specifically is that so?
Yes, Your Honor. The abuse of discretion would occur when the SJA prepared his addendum to this original SJR on December 1st. In that addendum, it details that additional time was given to trial defense counsel for clemency. Clemency wasn't submitted. Here is my addendum to the SJR. You may take your action now. When the SJA did that on December 1st, appellant's position is that he was abusing his discretion by taking the time to write out all those words, to write out the extra time he'd given trial defense counsel without taking the affirmative step of trying to communicate back with trial defense counsel why those clemency matters were not received, when every indication up to that point was that clemency matters would be submitted.
So you're not suggesting that on 12-1 that the SJA had any knowledge whatsoever that clemency matters had been attempted to be submitted or may have attempted to be submitted. He just knew that they hadn't been submitted on 12-1.
Your Honor, on December 1st, he would certainly have the knowledge that there was some attempt. Clemency matters would be forthcoming because there was a previous emails from trial defense counsel indicating that clemency matters would be forthcoming. So I would agree, Your Honor, that he did not have any knowledge that clemency matters were submitted, but I would not agree that he had no knowledge that clemency matters may be submitted. The previous indications to his deputy was that the clemency package is ready. It is ready to be submitted. We're waiting on this one letter from Lieutenant General Mattis.
So the burden's on the SJA to pull clemency matters once he has any information that they may be forthcoming, as opposed to the burden being on the defense to push them?
It sounds like
that's what you're saying.
I wouldn't argue that as a per se rule, Your Honor. What I would argue is that in an operational environment, there should be a reasonableness standard. In an operational environment, when matters are being transmitted via email, which is inherently unreliable, then certainly the SJA has, as his role as somebody, as one to ensure the fair play of post-trial processing, part of his responsibility when he's in that operational combat environment and relying on an inherently unreliable communication system is to take affirmative measures to determine whether or not there was a communication error.
Is that necessary for your case?
That is
say everybody was acting in good faith here. The defense thought they submitted on time. The government thought that there was no submission. Was there some other issue with this case?
Yes, Your Honor. There's the second aspect of the post-trial processing, which is after the community authority's action. Once that community authority action was communicated to trial defense counsel, and he realized that clemency matters, for whatever reason, had in fact not been submitted to the SJA and to the convening authority. In that case, he then sent a copy of his clemency matters to the SJA and explained to the SJA, hey, I thought I would send it. I asked my legal clerk to do that. Apparently, there was some error. Here are the matters right now. Appellant's second aspect of his case, as that was also error for the SJA at that point to not forward those matters to the convening authority. Once the SJA was aware of what had occurred and was also aware that appellant still requested clemency, it was not his role at that point to exercise a pocket veto and say, these clemency matters are late, you didn't meet the deadline, I'm not going to forward them.
How is it a pocket veto enforce the rules?
How does a pocket veto enforce the rules?
No, how is it a pocket veto if he simply complied with the rules? You know, there's a drop-dead date, there's no clemency package, end of story. How is that a pocket veto?
Well, there's two aspects to that, Your Honor. For one, the reasonableness standard, which I referred to earlier, that the SJA certainly had the SJA should have, as a matter of reasonableness, taken into account the communication error and forwarded that. But beyond that, for one, there is RCM 1107, which allows the convening authority to withdraw his action at any time prior to forwarding. Therefore, at that time, once the SJA was given knowledge that appellant still, in fact, did require clemency, but those matters had not been submitted to the convening authority, it was still possible for the convening authority to consider those clemency matters and adjust his action. Additional to that, as referred to in the lower court opinion, United States versus Bell, Article 1156 of the United States Navy regulations require officers to forward all correspondence to who it is addressed to. Clemency matters in this case were addressed to the convening authority, not to the SJA. The full extent of the SJA's power then was not to be the brick wall and stop those matters from going forward because they were late. They were addressed to the convening authority. He had to forward them. All he could have done is put enforcement on them saying, as per the RCMs, these are outside the deadline. My recommendation is that you're not considering.
Okay, so you're saying that there is a, you know, quite apart from reasonableness, you're saying that there is a positive duty imposed by some correspondence regulation on this officer to send this stuff to the convening authority regardless of when he gets it.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Anytime a service member addresses a letter to the commanding officer, that's particularly in terms of clemency or even a request mast, that is a right that they have to have that correspondence reach their commanding officer for his decision. It is the commander that makes the decision regarding these fundamental rights of service members. And again, it's his staff, his lawyer, or the other chain of command that puts their endorsements or recommendations on it. But ultimately speaking, any service member always has that right to pass matters on to his commander.
Okay. Can you cite us any case law for the rule of reason here in this context? Not Navy Marine Court case law, our case law.
Yes, sir. There's the general principle is that the essence of post-trial processing is fair play and justice. That's replete throughout this court's jurisprudence on this matter. In the way that the court has applied the standards towards defective SJRs as well, the court has taken a very a broad approach to protecting the rights of service members vis-a-vis SJRs and clemency matters. I think based on, again, that the essence of post-trial processing is fair play, I believe that provides authority for this reasonable standard outside of the RCMs and the other regulations cited by the appellant.
Okay. And why does the fact that there was eventually another SJAR and a convening authority action with this clemency package not save this?
Yes, Your Honor. The convening authority, admittedly, the same convening authority took action 1 year later.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, as the government argues, well, then there's no prejudice then. I think looking at this court's decision in United States versus Lowe, a 2003 decision, this court acknowledges that consideration of clemency matters not at the time they were submitted or at a timely period is a qualitatively different matter. It's a qualitatively different matter for the convening authority to consider clemency matters 1 year later.
General Mattis was not recommending clemency. He was recommending confinement reduction, wasn't he?
That is correct.
He wasn't otherwise generally recommending clemency or suggesting that the Marine be retained on active duty or not receive a BCD. Is that correct?
From his direct letter, that is correct, Your Honor. Although in the affidavit of trial defense counsel, they did refer to a previous meeting with Lieutenant General Mattis where he said he would fight with this Marine again.
But the ultimate letter that was submitted was a confinement-based letter. So that wasn't going to do him much good after he'd already served his confinement. On the other hand, how do you argue now with what sort of relief ought to be appropriate if you were right on everything?
Yes, sir. I think
you're arguing that the whole thing was keyed to Lieutenant General Mattis's letter, but in the end, Lieutenant General Mattis was only recommending confinement reduction.
Yes, Your Honor. I think fundamental aspect of this case, which perhaps distinguishes it from other cases, is that the appellant was in continuous confinement during this entire period, during this entire year delay between the two convening authorities' actions. His requested relief on clemency was both set aside of the punitive discharge and also a reduction in confinement. The fact that he served his entire period of confinement before the convening authority could consider his clemency matters materially prejudiced him. The convening authority at that point.
What relief are you looking for today, if you're correct?
Your Honor, at a minimum, to set aside a punitive discharge.
So you're asking us to grant something that Lieutenant General Mattis was not recommending?
Well, Your Honor, Lieutenant General Mattis limited his clemency to confinement. It's not, I mean, you can't speculate as to what he may have beyond that may have desired it. It's possible he may have wanted him to set aside punitive discharge. For whatever reasons he may have had on his own, he didn't include that in his letter. Because appellant had served all of his confinement at the time the convening authority considered his matters, reducing that requested clemency could no longer be granted because he'd already served his period of confinement. That is a qualitative difference and source of material prejudice to appellant. Because of that, based on the SJA's error, he could not receive part of the clemency he requested. Because of that, at this point, the only proper remedy would be to set aside the punitive discharge, which is what this court, in the 1997 decision, United States versus Cook, that's the first time this court acknowledged that you could have a remedy for this post-trial error besides simply remanding for another convening authority's action. This court acknowledged that on appeal, relief could be taken in reduction of sentence, and in Cook, the punitive discharge was set aside in this court by the lower court, and this court held that was not an abuse of discretion.
We should ignore the fact that when when another convening authority's action was taken with the clemency materials, that no clemency was granted?
Certainly it's a factor to consider, Your Honor. However, I think the fundamental analysis has to be, under United States versus Lowe, there was a qualitatively different position 1 year later.
Well, I understand that he was in a qualitatively different position vis-a-vis the fact that what Lieutenant General Mattis recommended, was not something that would be effectual, but not in a different position vis-a-vis what the convening authority could do.
Well, you know, as a legal matter, certainly the convening authority still had his full options available. I think looking at it practically in an overall perspective, you have a commander who has somebody who's been convicted and has served their entire sentence. At that point, he needs to, for him offering some type of sentencing relief, would be in a way, one, acknowledging that there's some type of, this person was entitled to something that he wasn't able to get, and sends an entirely different message to his command, which is a calculus that factors into the commander. And that's why this court's jurisprudence talks about when you have a taint of prejudice like that, sometimes you need to take post-trial action. Based on the SJA's error and the fact that a materially prejudiced appellant, this court should set aside the punitive discharge. I see that I'm out of time.
Thank you, counsel. You have an opportunity on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for the government.
Your Honors, may I please the court. My name is Major Brian Keller, and along with Colonel Louis Puglio, I represent the government. This case is about whether the lower court abused its discretion in granting only 3 months of relief for the one-year delay in executing a second convening authority's action. The government asks this court for the following opinion. The Court of Criminal Appeals correctly exercised its Article 66 discretion in granting 3 months of confinement relief for the delay in taking the second convening authority's action, even assuming that delay denied appellant any greater right to speedy review. We decline to grant additional relief. To fashion any relief that would be actually meaningful in this case would be disproportionate to the possible harm generated from the delay. Accordingly, we conclude that no additional relief is appropriate or warranted in this case over that granted by the court below. It is the defense's responsibility to check to make sure that clemency matters reach the convening authority, especially in a combat operation, as appellant points out. It's the convening authority's responsibility, of course, to move
counsel,
cases along.
What does that mean? Does that mean that the defense, in every case, has to do a return receipt on matters submitted to the convening authority?
Not necessarily, Your Honor, but certainly in this case, appellant himself acknowledges this was a combat operation, and there are different circumstances that go along with it being a combat operation. The answer is no, not never.
Wouldn't it be as an argument, it'd be even more desirable in a combat environment not to hassle lawyers with repeated emails?
Your Honor, in this case, I'm not sure I can answer that easily, Your Honor. In this case, certainly the convening authority, or at least the statute advocate, repeatedly contacted appellant to make sure the documents were received. Was the record of trial received? No. Was this document received? No. We'll send it to you. There was a bunch of emails from the deputy staff to the advocate.
Why does that even matter in this case? As I read the opinion of the court below, which you'd like us to affirm, is that the court below is proceeding, number one, on the assumption that the material was received in a timely fashion. That's on page 3. Even if this were determined to be the case, that is, that it was received and do not find error. They never make any determination other than that in this case. So they're proceeding on the assumption that the material was received in a timely fashion. Secondly, they're bothered by the fact that it took over a year for further action to be taken in the case, and they take corrective action on that. So again, they're proceeding on the assumption that the SJA improperly delayed the forwarding of the materials. So isn't that the posture of the case that we have before us right now? That is, one, that the material, we're proceeding on the assumption that the material was received before the first convening authority's action, and we're proceeding on the assumption that the SJA erred in not forwarding the materials in a timely fashion to the convening authority, and then we're focusing on the question of whether there's prejudice.
No,
are you asking us to revisit what and say that the Court of Criminal Appeals erred by not resolving the question of when the material was received, or the Court of Criminal Appeals erred by being by not focusing more on what the SJA should or should not have done when he received the materials?
No, Your Honor, the government disagrees with your reading of the case. From the way the government reads it, the lower court says, I think as you cited, Your Honor, based on the record before us, we're unable to determine whether these matters were submitted before or after that date. Now, to the government, that's a very generous way of telling defense counsel, and perhaps this court, that they did not submit it in a timely fashion. It is appellant's duty to submit clemency matters to the convening authority. Here, the Court of Criminal Appeals found they could not find by preponderance the evidence that it had been timely submitted. That's a finding of fact that says that it was not timely submitted. So, Your Honor, I guess the government disagrees with
that. They say we are unable to determine whether these materials were submitted before or after. They don't say that there's a record that they were submitted before or after.
Well, Your Honor, not being able to find whether they were submitted before or after, I think, is a clear finding that they were not timely submitted, because I think preponderance of the evidence is a 51% standard. It's over 50%. Here they're saying it's a toss-up whether they were timely submitted or not. So I think that's a clear finding of fact.
I mean, it seems to me that what they're finding, counsel, is they're not finding either way. They're saying that they can't determine from the record whether they were or were not, but they're going to, it doesn't matter, because at the end of the day, they don't think that he was prejudiced.
I think that's right, Your Honor. That's the government's position, is that the lower court did not abuse its Article 66 discretion in granting 3 months' relief. I do think that they are making a finding of fact there, and they are being overly generous to defense counsel, as is obvious. This would be a case to do that in, where defense counsel could have taken measures.
The fact is that they're unable to determine the fact.
Well, they're not finding that appellant has proven that he submitted the matters in a timely fashion. That's a finding of fact, Your Honor. I think that's pretty clear. They're saying it's 50-50, it's not over 50% preponderance of the evidence. I don't think that's splitting hairs to find that. They're saying we can't find that he timely submitted matters, is what they're saying.
They're saying that he avers that he submitted them, but they can't find it in the record.
They can't find that that's proven. Yes, Your Honor. And it's appellant's duty to show that he's timely submitted clemency matters.
I don't think I may be reading it differently. But I don't think they say here, based on the record before us, we were unable to determine that the appellant submitted the matters before the date. That's not what the opinion says. It says they're not able to determine whether it was before or after. And they don't say in here who has the burden and who failed to meet the burden.
No, that's right. I think you could read it that way. I think the government reads it as I think what they're doing is they're being generous, and they're saying, we're not going to say, we're saying it's an equal split, which means appellant has failed to meet his burden, that it is, that it was submitted timely. But I think, in the more general sense, it is appellant's duty to check, though, when he acknowledges that the email is spotty. I think there are several facts in the record that show that. The SJA addendum, of course, in this case, says that he didn't receive it. This staff judge advocate's email at JA-156 repeats that he didn't receive it. Individual military counsel's affidavit then, I think at JA-120, states that he knew that his clerk was not carrying out the duties that he assigned him on the 23rd, which is, of course, when General Mattis's letter was then submitted to the defense counsel office. By the 29th, which was 6 days later,
When defense counsel checked back, his clerk had still not carried out those duties. So if you read that as a finding of fact, which the government does, these facts support that. Even if you don't, that would show that it is the defense counsel's duty in some circumstances, certainly to check. In this case,
wait, the duty is to submit.
It's to submit, yes, Your Honor. But when the defense counsel knows, I think as he said in his email, that email from the East Coast to the West Coast is spotty, it is probably even worse to Iraq. If he's admitting that, then certainly he has reason to know in this combat operation that the committing authority may not receive it. The committing authority, of course, can't keep
checking. But isn't that an ambiguity in the law rather than, while it would be a good idea for someone to check, it says submit. It doesn't say submit and verify receipt. It says submit. So why isn't this a case where both parties acted in good faith? That the appellant submitted, albeit using the government computer system, it did not make its way through, and the government, the SJA, acted in good faith by proceeding in the absence of receipt.
Perhaps that's one way to read it, Your Honor. Of course, if it's just good faith, then the requirement, of course, is to get a receipt back for the government, but government
took a step extra. Does the law provide that? Does the law require defense counsel to receive a receipt for a clemency submission or merely to submit it?
No, it doesn't require defense to get that receipt, but my point was that the government, even though they're supposed to get a receipt, they went the extra step to keep checking by email to see if they'd actually received the documents because they knew that email was spotty. Defense counsel also acknowledged in his affidavit that he knew email was spotty. The clerk then, of course, in his affidavit said that his email had disappeared, so he somehow knew maybe after the fact that email was spotty. And nonetheless, defense did not make those checks back in the other direction. But the bottom line from all this is simply that in a combat operation, it's the defense's obligation to submit, certainly. But in circumstances like this where he knows that email is spotty, he probably should be the one to go that extra step and check to make sure it's being received by the convening authority, because the convening authority can't keep checking. It obviously occurs frequently.
But you're not arguing at the time that was required in the law?
No.
When the ranks
were of course not, Your Honor. But it would be a prudent thing. It would certainly be a prudent thing to do when defense counsel knows that email is not getting through.
How do you answer the appellant's contention that naval regulation required the SJA to kick this up to the convening authority, regardless of when it was received?
There's no proof. Well, first of all, it's an administrative requirement. And I think as in the cases which state that optional matters, for instance, in this case, the companion cases be noted in the convening authority's action, the failure to note administrative requirement is not fatal for the case. Second of all, of course, clemency is considered at the time of the convening authority's action. Here, the convening authority considered it at the second convening authority's action. And third, again, the government disagrees that the lower court is finding that they were timely submitted. Even if
but that's not their contention. Their contention is that regardless of whether they were timely submitted or not, he had a duty imposed by an independent regulation to forward them to the convening authority.
No, I understand, Your Honor. I think the first two points answer that, but the third point is, again, that the government disagrees that it was timely submitted. I think the Chief Judge's position was that the lower court held that it was timely submitted.
I did not take a position. What I read was the language from the lower court's opinion. Based on the record, we're unable to determine whether these matters were submitted before or after that date. Yet, even if this were determined to be the case, that is, as I read the case below, they are not making a determination that it was submitted before. They are proceeding on the assumption that it was submitted before and then finding no prejudice, something that appellate courts do all the time.
Yes, Your Honor. I understand. The government's position is also that appellate defense counsel misses the point of the Federal Rule of Civil Procedure exception. And the case that he cites, which is a federal court case, is a case, I believe, where the court had no notice that its motions or that its orders, rather, were not received by the appellant. And, of course, in the federal system, there's some kind of central tracking. I think it's the PACER system, where orders are logged and the failure to receive orders are also logged. And, of course, there's nothing like that in this case. But the point of that exception, as is noted by the committee report, is that email is spotty. And that's what defense counsel acknowledged in his affidavit in this case, and as did his clerk. The second point, of course, is that the convening authority properly took a second action, and it was a prophylactic action considering the clemency. As per the Court of Military Appeals Healy case, I believe in the 80s, where there was dicta suggesting that a second, that post-trial submitted clemency matters could merit a remand by the appellate courts for the convening authority in some cases to consider that clemency. Here was completely reasonable for the convening authority to go ahead and take a second convening authority's action to obviate that possibility of a remand.
The thing I don't understand, counsel, is why the government can't, you know, acknowledge that, you know, well, yes, it would have been better for the SDA to forward the clemency materials whenever he received them, and yes, once he received them, the committing authority should have taken a second action sooner than a year, but the lower court got it exactly right and already gave them, you know, relief for that problem. Instead of the argument that I hear you making, which is SJA can hold on to stuff for forever, et cetera, et cetera.
If that's the argument that it sounds like the government's making, that's not the argument we're making. The only argument we're making is that factually, I think the lower court did make a determination and it was being generous in how it worded it. But no, the delay here of 1 year, the delay in taking action, we're not sure how long it took to get there. All we know is that it took a year to take that second action. That delay is lamentable and it should never have happened. Of course, the lower court found that there was no due process error in that 1 year delay plus the 153 odd days after that to docket the case with the lower court. But no, the government agrees that that delay should never have happened, and the government is conceding that. The bottom line, however, is that a sergeant of Marines who leads his subordinates into a plan to deliver electric shocks to Iraqi detainees or one Iraqi detainee is not the case to afford any additional relief. The blame, though, certainly goes around in this case for the delay. In the 1997 Cook decision, which is cited by appellant, citing to Griffin, which is a 57 decision, I think, the Court of Criminal Appeals, of course, reassessed the sentence and disapproved the bad conduct discharge because there was no indication that the convening authority considered clemency matters. Here, of course, we have a second convening authority action taken for the Healy dicta, which considers the clemency matters and decides to grant only 3 months' relief. This court held that the critical inquiry in cases like that is whether justice to the accused requires a new start and a redetermination of the sentence by the primary authority, and certainly in this case it does not. In sum, the lower court acted within its Article 66 discretion, and to fashion any further relief in the case of a sergeant of Marines who led his junior Marines into a plan to deliver electric shocks to an Iraqi detainee would be far disproportionate to any possible harm generated from the delay in taking a second action in this case. If there are no further questions, that concludes the government's argument.
Thank you, counsel. Is there a rebuttal from the defense?
Yes, sir.
Your Honor, it should be acknowledged that the Article 66 relief granted by the lower court was for the total post-trial delay for the entire case and was not a specific redress for the error considered by this court. The lower court did not rule that there was any type of error for the SJA's conduct, that there was any type of pocket veto. So this court should assess the Article 66 relief granted by the lower court as relief for a separate matter, which is an overall post-trial delay. Secondly, Your Honor, regarding the Navy regulations, the Appellate Government Council cites case law to say that it's an administrative requirement, therefore it's not fatal. While it certainly would be true as a general matter that violation of administrative regulation or requirement may not be an appealable issue, in this case it's not violation of that regulation, which is the discrete legal issue. The discrete legal issue is the SJA's conduct vis-a-vis the clemency and communicating the convening authority. And the Navy regulations underscore his conduct regarding the clemency matters. So while they're not an independent basis to set aside the case, they inform upon his abuse of discretion and his overall conduct.
Let's say you're right on the law and your client was prejudiced. You've indicated the only thing left on the table is the BCD. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
He served his confinement and he was passed his EAS. So what's your best argument for why it's appropriate, or whatever the right legal standard is in this case, for us to do away with the BCD?
Yes, Your Honor. Looking at the sweep of the case law from the 80s and 90s, culminating in lower court decision Bell, it's create an acknowledgement that certain errors can only be remedied on appeal by setting aside a penal discharge. In this case,
we have a long line of cases now with the Marino family raising concern about disproportionate relief. Why would this be proportionate relief?
It's simply looking at the equities of the matter, whether it would be proportionate or disproportionate. It should be considered the nature of the crime. Sergeant Travis's plan was to electrocute the cell itself, not electrocute the detainee. He was not present when the actual crime occurred. The person who actually electrocuted the detainee, Private Sting, his punitive discharge was set aside by the convening authority. So as an equitable matter, looking at it globally, would it be disproportionate to set aside Sergeant Travis's BCD? In this case, it would not be. You have a decorated Marine with multiple combat tours who was not present when the actual injury occurred, nor was there evidence raised that any actual injury occurred.
So was the Court of Criminal Appeals incorrect on footnote 4 on page 4 when they suggested that he was entitled to pay during the period between the first action and when the convening authority took action in 2005?
No, Your Honor, I would not argue that they were incorrect.
So, on what date was this accused in a position where he was no longer entitled to pay?
I see I'm out of time, Your Honor.
You can take the time to answer that question.
Your Honor, I'm not specifically aware when his EAS was, but whatever day his EAS expired would appear to be when he was no longer entitled to pay.
And is it the defense position that none of the time for which his confinement was approved by the CCA involved a period in which he was entitled to pay?
I do not know the answer to that question.
So it is possible that he could get relief other than remittal or disapproval of the BCD in this case?
Yes, that would be possible.
When was he sentenced?
He was sentenced on August 19th.
Yeah, the problem may be with my question, not with your answer. In his EAS, let's stipulate for the purpose of the question only that his EAS was 29 November 2004. What's your answer to the question?
In that case, he would have received some, he would not have been entitled to any pay at any rate, and then the setting aside of the automatic forfeitures would not have benefited him.
So if that's the case, then the Court of Criminal Appeals didn't understand the case that was before them.
That is correct, Your Honor. If there are no further questions, I see that concludes my time.
Given the nature of that, you may be seated. Given the nature of these questions, does the government have anything particular, not in terms of argument, but in terms of items in the record you would like to point to with respect to that last series of questions on the EAS? If not, we'll just conclude. Thank you. The case is now submitted, and the court will stand in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 a.m.
The court stands in recess until 9 a.m. tomorrow.